Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, July 22nd, 1998. In the Creekside Room this afternoon is Ana Maria Pineda and is titled Dia de los Muertos en Nuvanarios, The Extended Goodbye. Let's listen in.
Welcome to the session on Dia de los Muertos and Novenarios. Novenario means 9 days, and I'll explain it as we go along. A very brief introduction for those of you who haven't met me yet. My name is Ana Maria Pineda. I've been here since last week. I'm teaching in Santa Clara University, in a local part of California. I'm a sister of Mercy, a Roman Catholic. Was born in Central America in El Salvador and came to the States when I was 2 years old and settled in the area of San Francisco that's very affectionately called the Mission, which is the Hispanic or the Latino neighborhood of that city. So that's where I grew up in all that splendid mix of Latin American countries and personalities and temperaments. It was quite exciting. But today we're going to talk about a topic that's important for us and for all of us, and of course is celebrated in a particular way because it's placed in the context of the culture. And what I will do is briefly give you a little introduction to the idea of Dia de los Muertos, the Day of the Dead. We have an altar here that tries to simulate what could be typical of the Day of the Dead. It's not exactly, but it's at least to give you an idea. And then I'm going to show you a short portion of a longer video that was entitled, I don't remember the exact title, but it was covering the rituals of death around the world. But we can't see all of it because we don't have time. So I'm going to show you just the portion that has to do with the Day of the Dead in Mexico, in a particular place. So what should I say about the Day of the Dead before I begin? The important thing to do is to place it in the context, first of all, of relationships and of a particular worldview. And in the Hispanic and indigenous worldview, relationships are not only important, but extend beyond the world of the material. They also include the world of creation, the spirit world, and we have an idea of the extended family that I talked about in an earlier session, where you're not only talking about parents or children, you're talking about grandparents, you're talking about aunts and uncles. You're also talking about brother-in-laws and sister-in-laws, relatives that belong to your siblings because they are married into that family, but also become part of your family. You're talking also about godparents that take a child to be baptized and they become part of the family. And you're also talking about adopted family, people who aren't even related to you, not only by blood, but by culture, but somehow become an intimate part of the family. And in that whole idea of extended family, we also have a wonderful place for the deceased, those who have been with us physically and who are now existing in the spiritual realm, if you will, but really not in many ways. It's very concrete, very present to us, so present that it's not unusual to have people tell you that they talk to relatives that have gone before them, and they have these conversations, and they're very intimate in times of joy or in times of sorrow, in times of need, in times of wanting counsel or direction. So the deceased are an intimate part of our reality. I think there's also a different notion about death, because for us, death is the flip side. Well, life and death are part of the same reality. And life leads us into death, which is the fullness of reality. So we don't share in the same way the idea of an interrupted life. It is part of life. It is not an interruption. It's a fulfillment of life. And death is a reality that we try and face directly, that we laugh about, that we joke about. Leo Sarko is going to tell us a little bit about the altar and some of the items that are found on the altar. But in the Latino reality, you try and make death your friend. And that's why in many of the depictions of death, it has a laughing face, because you joke about it, you tell stories about it. And it's as if to befriend it and to take the fear out of it, because it is your companion. And as it is your companion even as you live, each day we die, but it's really into the fullness of life. So there's a different concept. The concept of death, I think, that we have today is also a combination. It's a combination of what was pre-Columbian before the Spaniards came, and also then became connected to some of the Christian rituals that were brought in by the missionaries. So you can say that it's an integration or a mixture of both of those elements. And when is the Day of the Dead celebrated? It's celebrated very much following the calendar of the Catholic Church liturgically, but with different directions. So on November the 1st, which is the day of All Saints Day in the Catholic Church, it's not unusual that what's being celebrated is the celebration of children who have died, the deceased souls of children. And then you also celebrate the saints, but that day is dedicated. And often what happens is that the altar is prepared with the favorite toys or beloved objects that the child used to love to play with and have. And that's, I borrowed some books from the library and a little Pinocchio type figure just to give us that idea. And then on November the 2nd, which on the Roman calendar would be All Souls Day, then we remember the deceased, those who have gone before us. And that's that day is devoted particularly to them. So this is just to give you a slight introduction. I'm going to show the film, which is about 7 or 8 minutes long. And then I'll move into the novenario. And then after that, have Sadhguru explain some of the altar and a little bit more about how they celebrate Day of the Dead in Arizona to give us another idea or view of it. Any questions so far? I will just pray that this works right. I think it should, but it's a very short portion. And this gentleman has gone to different parts of the world, and he's now in Mexico. I was having trouble with the track, but we'll just do the best we can. This is Mexico. It will tell you.
Some bizarre death theme park. This is the main plaza in Pátzcuaro, Mexico, 150 miles west of Mexico City. It's October 31st, my Halloween, but here it's the Night of the Dead, that one time each year when the Mexican people step up to the edge of the cabin and invite their dead ancestors to come back home, pull up a chair, and relax. No rubber masks, no tricks or treats, but a private meeting between descending and ascending. The Mexican, wrote Octavio Paz, jokes about death, caresses it, sleeps with it, celebrates it. It is one of his favorite toys and his most steadfast love. In the Pátzcuaro Square, there are flowers given your love. The old ladies say cut flowers are just the right image for the Night of the Dead. They are dead, but still beautiful. Besides flowers of death, there are also toys of death. And they all seem to have one purpose, to reduce death to just another being who watches TV, uses the toilet, and toasts for sugar cane.
It's interesting how quickly figures like these don't seem appallingly garish, but in fact funny and even meaningful. Death and life are so intertwined, they say, that death figures can do everyday living things. Though, if I were to buy this one, take it home to my friend, the obstetrician, I don't think he'd see the joke.
He might be, but that's probably all he'd see. For the people of Mexico, though, the Night of the Dead is a lot more than just an annual macabre joke. It serves the same purpose as my Halloween. But unlike mine, this Halloween hasn't been stripped, cleaned, and deboned of all its original meaning. Pascuaro and the tiny island of Huron are separated by only 100 yards of green, leech-filled water. Umazinda, and their children and grandchildren. They are Curacachon Indians, proud of their faith, their heritage, and today especially proud of the family altar they've lovingly created for the Night of the Dead.
This is the way we're offering the spirits of our ancestors, our dead. When they come back later tonight, this cone you see is their head and the Coca-Colas. Those were the refreshments they liked. My mother and father liked fruit, so we have lots of fruit. Everything you see here will be eaten by us eventually, but it won't have any taste. The taste will be absorbed by the spirits.
Dinas is a hard-working farmer and fisherman with little time for fantasy. Does he really believe the spirits of his ancestral dead are dropping in later tonight for a Coca-Cola? He was told me that his late father-in-law pounded on the walls of this house for 2 hours one Night of the Dead because the altar wasn't ready yet. His father-in-law, Dimas says, is a very impatient man, even dead. Before their deceased relatives arrive for snacks, the Urundan families gather on top of the island to hold a service in the church courtyard. Prayers are read by the family fathers because Urundan has no resident priest. But the community involvement in the event makes it all that more heartfelt. When the service is over, they go back down the hill to wait for their ancestral guests to arrive. 10 miles from Urundan, back on the mainland, is the town of Sinsinsan, where the Night of the Dead is observed by an all-night vigil in the town cemetery. Sinsinsan families have spent days cleaning and decorating their ancestors' graves. Now they sit in reverence, but also in defense. Another strange group has arrived in Sinsinsan this night, besides the spirits of the dead. Tourists, thousands of them, come to see a real old-fashioned Noche de los Muertos. Inside the graveyard walls, the tourists jockey for position on the muddy paths to catch that perfect snapshot of genuine religious rapture before their bus leaves for the next stop on the three cemeteries. It's hard for me not to feel very uncomfortable about the tourist frenzy that's going on here right now. I've always thought graveyards were quiet, contemplative, reverent places. And though the people at Sinsinsan show a remarkable ability to ignore their more obnoxious visitors standing a few feet away, they're still outnumbered by them 15-1. But they put up with it. And not because they have to, but because they want to. There's a financial reason, of course. A lot of Sinsinsanos are selling hot dogs and tacos tonight. But there's also a spiritual reason. I look at this crowd of gawkers and want to get back to Dinas Castillo's place in New London. The Cincinnatians look and see not tourists, but guests. It's almost as if confronting death is not quite enough. Someone must see you do it. Juan Nacional's wife, Marcelina, died just 2 months ago. So he is one of the few townspeople here tonight, in actual mourning. If anyone besides me is offended by the frenzy, it should be him. But Juan says the tourists don't bother him. In fact, they honor him, the town, and Marcelina's memory. In the middle of the night, town priest Efrain Cervantes conducts a brief mass. And after that, the night of the dead in Tsinsan becomes an increasingly private affair. A few hours later, the tourist, the priest, and even the Castillos back on Aranda are snug in their beds. But Juan Nacarino is still here with his grief, his memories, and maybe, just maybe, with the spirit of his Marcelina. This is the graveyard of St. Martin's Church in Warren, Wales. And this is the great poet Dylan Thomas, a particular hero. As an unbaptized Unitarian, intellectually, I don't think there's anything in Thomas here.
It's an interesting video.
What's the series?
It was on TV. I forget the exact title, but it goes on to tell that even he goes to this place to remember this wonderful figure in literature, and that he's always wanted to, and his voice gets all kind of choked up. But I think that gives you a little bit of a flavor. I'm not going to go into that much right now, besides the introduction. What I'm going to do is move into some of the practices that accompany death in the Latino community, and then have Sato explain the altar and other practices. There's so much to say that there's always so little time to say it all. And I usually like to leave a lot more time for conversation, but I'm not sure that we're going to be able to do that today. But I'm around as well. In the Gospel of John, there's a very telling passage that brings out for us the attitude of other cultures toward death and how they deal with death and the reality of mourning. And we have a wonderful example in the Gospel of John. And Jesus is called to Bethany because Lazarus was ill and dying, and by the time he arrived, he had died. So this continues. When Mary came where Jesus was and saw him, she knelt at his feet and said to him, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." When Jesus saw her weeping and the Jews who came with her also weeping, he was greatly disturbed in spirit and deeply moved. He said, "Where have you laid him?" They said to him, "Lord, come and see." Jesus began to weep. So the Jews said, "See how he loved him." But some of them said, "Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying?" Then Jesus, again greatly disturbed, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone was lying against it. We see in this passage the great humanity of Jesus and how he accompanies the culture of his people, which was to lament and to weep and to show loss at the death of a loved one. And I think that's very much in the spirit of the Hispanic or Latino community, where all these effective shows of loss are very much accepted and celebrated and expected. Hispanics deal directly with death, and as you saw in the short video, you try and make it your friend. It becomes part of the family household, part of the stories, part of the jokes, so that death does become a friend and a companion. And children are not exempt from this experience. Children are made part of it, and they are asked to accompany the adults very often to the final goodbyes, the ritual taping, the mortuaries where prayers are said, where stories are told. And they are taken as well to the funeral of mass or rituals, to the cemetery. And it's not unusual at the cemetery for Hispanics to really grieve today the loss of actually seeing the coffin buried, you know, placed into the plot. Today it's becoming very sanitized. You know, you leave it there and then you go away. Well, for Hispanics, unless you see it go into the ground and you yourself toss dirt in as a gesture of acompañamiento, of accompanying, of being a participant in the goodbyes that take place, it doesn't feel complete. When you go to what we often do is like a rosary or a scriptural celebration before the burial day, and you come up to mourn with those who mourn, there's an expression that is often said, and that is, te acompaño, I accompany you in your loss, I accompany you in your sorrow. And one of the wonderful occurrences is that after the burial, we all have good intentions. We all grieve with those who have lost a loved one, and we all want to be there for them. But our regular activities of life kind of seize us, and before we know it, all these good promises and good intentions aren't materialized, and people are alone to grieve, or are not accompanied with their grieving. So in the Latino community, what we have is called the novenario. I have a bit of a cold, so I'm sipping. And what the novenario is, 9 days after the burial, it's customary for family and friends to join those who are mourning. They go to their homes for 9 consecutive nights, and they pray with them. But the wonderful part about it is, it's not just the prayers, it's the socializing that takes place. And it's all the wonderful storytelling that takes place. Someone once referred to it as the extended goodbye. You never really quite say goodbye, but you help and you accompany those who have a need to express their sorrow, who have a need to make that person still present in their life. It is, that person has been part of their life and continues to be. And it's wonderful storytelling. And all the faults of that individual are forgotten in death. All of a sudden, they become affectionate sides of these terrible personalities. You saw in the video, you know, he said, my father-in-law was always a little bit demanding. He's pounding on the door or on the house because the altar isn't quite ready. Well, it's delightful. You tell stories and you remember times that you shared together, and the better qualities of these people come to the light, and children remember. I remember my father's, the night before the burial, I was asked to say a few words, and I got up and I said something about how my father was a stubborn old man, because he had a stroke 20 years earlier, and we really thought he wasn't going to make it. Well, he lived 20 years more, because he had a lot that he still wanted to see brought to completion. He wanted to see my younger brother married and settled and so forth and so forth. My niece was 4 years old, and a couple of years later, she said to me, remember when you said that Papa was a stubborn old man? I said, when did I say? Remember? And she described the night, and it's very interesting how everyone becomes part of the storytelling and remembers this. Now that may not have been my father's finest quality, but it was one of his qualities. Virgil Elizondo, who is a Mexican-American theologian, has said, he's the father for us of U.S. Hispanic theology, has said, there's 3 kinds of death. One is when you physically die. The second one is when you are buried. But the third and the most terrible one is when you are forgotten. And that's why in the Latino community, the power of memory is important. And the 9 days come and the 9 days go. But that gives us time to accompany the person, the family, those who are grieving, and also to share our own sorrow and lament. And many families deal with this differently, because even after that time, there is a whole practice of anniversary, where the first anniversary of death, you may have a mass, you may have a prayer gathering, but there's always a social accompanied with it. Those that come participate in a party, and you give little mementos, like little cards with the name of the deceased, a little prayer that goes with it, or sometimes a medal, or something that was of particular religious importance to that person. So you continue, it's the extent of goodbye, and you never say goodbye, because at family gatherings, the stories continue to be told, so that the memory of those who are deceased continue to be part of your life and continue to be present. And it's very important for children, and also for us as adults, to have that as a ritual and as a practice. So that, those are my brief comments. And Sako, do you want to do us the favor of saying a little bit more about what could be an altar and then how it's practiced?
Okay, well, I'd like to kind of like bring this, put it more in scope to what's happening in the U.S. And how that Mexican culture has influenced us in Arizona. Carmen and myself, we live in the Phoenix area. And I am myself of Mexican descent, but my family never came to the U.S. The U.S. came to us when the Southwest was Mexico. So we don't have a real link with Mexico, but we are very much a part of the Southwest and the culture of the Southwest that was very, very Mexican until only less than about 100 years ago. It really became part of what we call the United States of America. But Dia de los Muertos was really important to us because, first of all, for Mexican Americans or even Mexican immigrants in this country, you have a celebration of Cinco de Mayo and the 16th of September, which are independence holidays in Mexico, but those don't really mean anything to us and Mexicans in the Southwest or immigrants anymore. And besides that, it's very insulting to us that it has become so commercialized. Cinco de Mayo and, is a reason to sell beer to the Mexican community by Michelob and Budweiser, and they put millions of dollars into promoting Cinco de Mayo to sell beer to our community. So that's a real turnoff, it's a real insult to us. As a matter of fact, Anglo-Americans are the ones who celebrate Cinco de Mayo more than really we do. And so Dia de los Muertos, even though we really didn't practice Dia de los Muertos as a community anymore, because the community has been divided and disrupted in so many ways. Dia de los Muertos was enacted maybe on a personal level in each family household. There were some communities that, or barrios that you might want to call them, that you did have some type of Dia de los Muertos celebration, maybe in the cemetery where the graves were cleaned and the dead were remembered, and maybe sometimes the church was involved, some aspect of the church, especially if they were of majority of Mexican people or some Mexican indigenous communities that exist in Arizona and the Southwest. But in the late 60s and early 70s, there was a big movement around Cesar Chavez and the farm workers movement. This created a pride, and we had someone who we could be proud of, and we had something to struggle for. The community came together, and the artists and the activists looked back to Mexico for our traditions, for our culture, for our language. We wanted to keep those things alive. They were necessary. They were meaningful. Everybody was trying to grasp it, at heritage, at culture, at their roots. You all remember that part of our lives. Well, anyway, for us, it was right there. It was right there in Mexico. Much of it was still alive in our communities. We had our elders. We always remembered our ancestors. So Dia de los Muertos was a wonderful excuse to celebrate our culture and to remember our ancestors. And we're talking about ancestors, we're not just talking about our grandfathers, our grandmothers, but we're talking about our indigenous past that has been denied us growing up and in school. I actually grew up with teachers telling me we had no history. We had no past. They told me that, and I grew up with that idea. But when we started celebrating Dia de los Muertos, we were remembering not only, as I mentioned, our immediate relatives, but our ancestors. What did they have to teach us what were the wonderful things that they had that were relevant today to us as contemporary urban dwellers? Well, first of all, their relationship with the natural world, their relationship to the animal kingdom, to the earth, to the spiritual realm. And so we had all this richness that we could bring back. So we started a deal that was Muertos Festival. Instead of going to the graveyards and cleaning up the graves as a community, we came together as a community to celebrate the Day of the Dead and talk about our ancestors through music, through dance, through ceremony, through ritual. So that means it was a whole community was involved, a whole community of artists, of dancers, of actors, and people in the community, especially the kids. So the festival became a place where people could come together and they could see the skull, the what we call pelatas. And they're a skull that's highly decorated with a very sinister, mischievous smile. So that the people at the festival, while all these different events were going on, they actually got a chance to look death in the face and to dance with death. So in the festival, you have all these skeleton dancers, these calaca dancers, and people are interacting with them and talking with them. And instead of the skeletons scaring them, they entice them to dance and to move and to laugh and to smile. So this is all in conjunction with community altars being built, where people are bringing photographs of their loved ones or lighting candles to their loved ones, bringing flowers to the altars. And now we have, after 20 years, it's not just a Mexican-American or a Mexican event, but we have all aspects of the community. Not only do we have a big influx of people from Guatemala, from Salvador, but a lot of Anglo people come and they tell us, this is the only time I get a chance to really grieve. My culture has not provided me a chance to grieve for the person that I've lost. And they come every year and they bring their family. So for us, this aspect of our culture has been our gift to the rest of the community, to humanity, so to speak. So not only was it resurrected in Phoenix in the Southwest, and I'm proud to say that we have probably one of the most elaborate and the most inclusive of all the Dia de los Muertos in the Southwest, but there's Dia de los Muertos in all over Texas, New Mexico, all over the state of California, in Colorado. You're finding that Dia de los Muertos is really growing and really encompassing more and more. What we've done lately with Dia de los Muertos, because we have three celebrations in three different parts of the city, now we have what we call La Procesión. And La Procesión is a procession where last year we did the first one, we've invited people of the community to make altars, portable altars, because people make altars in their homes like Ana Maria has described, and like you saw in the video, where you worship as a family and then you go and you worship as a community. Well, this way, people make altars to victims of violence, people who've been killed in gun violence, in drunk driving accidents, in domestic violence. And we thought we were going to have a real small, intimate festival, but it was just unbelievable how many people showed up with makeshift altars. They could have been just simply cardboard boxes decorated with paper and candles and photographs and maybe a little story about how they were killed in gang violence. We had instances where we had a young kid who was 16 years old who supposedly pulled a pocket knife on three police officers and was shot 150 times. Now, how do you explain that? Well, the police were part of we involved them in this procession because we marched down the street, we had to close the streets. We had their full cooperation. And at that festival, we had three or four altars for victims who were killed by police. They were all Mexican or blacks that were killed by police and under real weird circumstances. And this was very interesting because the police officers who were there, you know, they said that they were very uncomfortable about these altars being made in light of what happened. But they said, well, these things are going to haunt us forever. The fact that this happened, we as the police department, we committed these atrocities. We cannot forget this. This has to be kept alive, and we cannot forget it. We have to create a dialogue. So we had all these people that brought these altars, and each person was able to go from altar to altar and talk about these victims and why they died and how they died and how we can deal with this issue of violence and violent death in our society. So it's becoming even more elaborate. We have more artists involved, other people who never considered themselves artists, who never made anything, who never created an altar for them. They buried them, they're dead, they're gone, they're forgotten. Well, now they have a time of year where now they can they can adopt this cultural form of ritual and ceremony and incorporate it into their own lives. And by doing so, according to their testimonies, they're being able to live a fuller, a richer life, knowing that their loved ones are still there amongst them. If not, throughout the whole year, at least one night a year, they come back and they can remember their lives, and and as well as crying and mourning, they can laugh and embrace death and not be afraid to die, because they're going to be able to be reunited again with their loved ones. Is there anything you want to add to that, Carmen?
I was just going to say about the altar that what we do in our family, we do paprika, which is a paper cutout, and we do that prior to these muertos, and it's an opportunity for our family to pass on the history of our ancestors that my kids will never know my mother as well as I did, because she died at 2 or 3 years old, and I was able to grow into a full adult. So we are coming out and decorating the house in memory of our loved ones, and then all the stories come out that our children know about things that are mundane, but it keeps the memory alive. We also put food in the altar, because supposedly the dead communicate with us. They come and eat the food with us. They share the food with us. So like you saw in the movie, they put the special, their favorite foods, like if it was a Coca-Cola, they put a Coca-Cola in the altar. Our altars also has the pictures of all the people that have died. So we start doing an altar that's very simple, but ends up, by the time the dead comes, it's a huge thing. It takes over our whole living room. Because the kids will do projects in school. I have 7 and 9-year-old children. And they'll go to school, and the art teacher will give them a piece of paper, and they'll do something that reminds them of their grandfather, their grandmother, their aunt, and they come and they put in the altar. Or they find a flower in the backyard, and they come and put in the altar. So the altar is not just something to remind the people, but to also something that from nature, something from us, you know. So it becomes increasingly bigger and more elaborate.
And what's interesting, I've noticed too, I mean, just about every home you go to, Anglo or Hispanic, whatever, you have the hallway or someplace decorated with all the photographs of the family, which is wonderful. In a sense, that's an altar. But it becomes a ritual when you take them down from the wall and you put them in another context with offerings of the food, of the flowers, of the scents. The smell is very, very important in our community, that the smells of the food cooking. Because then that brings back that person again. You know, they love this certain meal you prepared, and you remember them again. So by putting those things in that context, and by incorporating the labor of the children and grandparents who's ever there, it becomes more. It becomes not ordinary. It becomes extraordinary. It becomes almost not. You know, it's natural, but it's supernatural through the ceremony, and therefore it's very uplifting. The spirit is uplifted. The family comes together, and it's that third death that we refuse to let happen. They died. They're buried, but we refuse to let those memories go. And to me, in many ways, the memory of my ancestors that I never knew, and everything they had to teach me and the rest of our modern society, I refuse to let those teachings, those memories go. Those are the things that I want to pass on to my children, as well as my mother that they interviewed. Those ancestors that lived 500, 1,000 years ago are very, very important as well.
Yes, Roberta.
Well, I want to make a comment about this within a specifically Christian context within the whole history of the church. This was a seems to have been a very similar practice in the early church, that Christians would go once a year and have picnics at the cemetery at the tombs of their dead and bring food and leave food for the dead. And this, for in our sanitized modern life, we could think that's really an odd idea. That's a sort of primitive idea in some ways. But the notion that the Christian context in which this makes sense, and it makes strong sense, is this is a participation in the communion of the saints. That we claim that we share a common life with Christians before us and who will come after us. And this is a concretizing of this and saying this is not just a nice idea. Protestants often have a hard time with the notion of Catholics praying to the saints and say, how could that, that's just not that's not monotheism. But the answer to that is that we ask each other in this life to pray for each other. And what is the difference between asking Anna Maria to pray for me and asking my aunt, who died 5 years ago, to pray for me and to pray for her? So this is not a sort of, insofar as it has indigenous roots, it's also Christian. It's part of our tradition that's dropped out within certain parts of the church.
Well, when the Spaniards came to Mexico, Mexicans already had this very elaborate cult of death. There was already Dia de los Muertos. But the Spanish also brought with them their own cult of death. That wasn't too long after the Inquisition. So when they came with them, they brought a whole cult of death, and they coincided as far as time. They were about the same time, so it was very easy for that blending to happen, for that hybrid Dia de los Muertos to happen. Even though we feel there is a lot of some Christian overtone, as you saw, it is definitely an indigenous celebration. Now, what I see when we celebrate Dia de los Muertos, as we do, and seeing Halloween with vampires and ghouls and masks with eyeballs hanging out and all this sinister, all these horrible, horrible images of death and dismemberment and whatever. We're dealing with something that's much more primal and physical and almost to the point of that deals more with satanic imagery than Christian imagery. It's almost a slap in the face to Christianity. But still in our society, people say Dia de los Muertos, they see the skull and, but if they see a vampire with blood all over his teeth and all this, that's fine. They can live with that.
But we have a little bit of time for more conversation. And also I'd like to ask us to think about what rituals might exist in our own home or communities that have a way of remembering the dead, that have a way of making it an ongoing part of the family, a communion of saints, as Roberta points out.
Yes. I live in Northwest Washington, and about 3 years ago, one of our two funeral homes in the community just decided to try something. It was at Christmas time. The funeral director is fairly progressive and realized that Christmas is a very difficult time for people who have just experienced death. And so what he did is he sent out notices to people, I thought it was just to people who had lost loved ones in death that year, inviting them to come to a memorial service. And what was surprising, the two things that were so surprising, one was the number of people who came, but the other thing that was very surprising, everybody got to write the name of the person, and then they had a reading and lighting of candles and all that. Some of these people who came had lost loved ones 10, 15 years ago, and that's what really opened up his eyes, and he realized, boy, this stuff is not These people have never had an opportunity to do anything after the funeral. So now it's become a yearly event, and a really important one.
It's really important.
We have friends whose three-year-old daughter died very suddenly of spinal meningitis. And her name was Katie, and she died in July, but her birthday was December 28th. And so every year in December, a group of friends, I suppose about eight families or so, would gather for a meal and a time of telling the stories about Katie in her brief 3 years. And then each year we would bring gifts for a particular individual or family in need. We would know about them ahead of time, so we would know what their needs might be. And then we would bring our gifts that the family would then bring to social services or whatever, and have them shared. And then it was neat because then it gave that family also a chance to share their story, their humbling, painful story with us. And it made for a very, very rich experience.
And an important one, because I think what often happens after the death of a loved one, sometimes we think that by not talking about them, the person's going to feel better. And the person's dying to talk about them because they need to. It's a person that's been so much part of their lives, they have to talk about this person. And our response is not to, partly because we think it's going to hurt them, but partly because we ourselves don't know how to handle it. And so it's a way of us keeping our distance from having to deal with it. Yes.
It's the first time I've heard this contrast between the American Halloween and the Mexican view of facing death and dancing with it. And I really appreciate, you know, hearing this, and we'll work with my own kids and talking about it when Halloween starts coming around again.
And helping them and helping ourselves be attentive to having them accompany us when their services for those who die. I think we don't do them a favor by shielding them. I don't know what's gained by that. You know, that's part of my life, that's part of my life.
I really regret the loss of candles in churches and the opportunity to light your little black box with the candles. For me, that's always been an opportunity for memorial. I can spend time. There may be a figure or a picture, but it's just an opportunity to offer it up. And like you were talking about, it's the heat and it's the smell and it's the feel and it's the the stick and it's the sand. It's all those things. Mm-hmm. It's a very sensual thing, and a flickering light is horrible. And put on by a switch. And it's like television. It's like in television. David likes those marathons on television, it's the same.
Right.
And it's just not. So I would offer that.
It's helping all of us partake in the ritual, our whole being to be taken into that moment. And I think it was also the suffering center at a moment. Ritual helps us, in a way, leave what seems ordinary and enter into the sacred or to the extraordinary, into the spiritual, and helps us commune with that reality. Yes.
In a way, it seems to me like I just thought of this. There seems to be kind of a movement, or it's popular, to go to the opposite of what we're talking about. People are having private burials now, it's private, and then they may have a memorial service where you don't see the body, you don't touch the body, you don't do any of those things, you are suppressing, but there seems to be, it's becoming very trendy nowadays, and that's just the opposite of what we're talking about.
Cremation. Is cremation popular among Mexican people?
It does, but I'm not sure that it's because the other part of it, which you reminded me by your words, is the need to touch, like we're in the mortuary, and people people might find this very strange, but you go up and you touch the person, you kiss the person on the forehead, you hold their hand, the person is dead. But that person was someone you loved and you did that in life. And people that don't live it in that context find it strange. But this is, you know, this is life, this is reality for us.
One of our members is originally from Tanzania, and her husband recently died there, and she and her oldest daughter, we arranged for them to visit several months after he had died. And they brought back, and they had developed an entire photo album of the visit to the grave, the service, the celebration afterwards. And it was interesting because I'm sitting there going, okay, what am I doing with this photo album of her prostrating herself? I mean, pages of her, of herself and her children prostrating themselves on the grass. I mean, there was an entire ritual that they did in clearing things, laying flowers, sprinkling, I don't know what all they did, but it was an entire photo album.
Well, we take photos of people in the mortuary, and people say that's very strange. But that's a memory. That's part of our relationship. That's part of the reality of that person, part of their life.
I think that the two hardest deaths I had to deal with were my father's and my aunt's, who was his sister. And one of the things that was hard about my father was that he died of emphysema, and for about a year before he died, he wouldn't let any of his children visit him at all. First of all, because he was too proud to let any of us see him. And the other thing is that he just won John, and he just, you know, that would be it. But it was really important when he died at the funeral home to be able to touch him. It was just, I mean, it makes me want to cry just thinking about how important he was, because I haven't been able to for such a long time. When my aunt died, I don't think I'll ever get over this one. It was after my father had died, and there was nobody really alive on that side of the family. My father had left my mother when I was 12, and everybody on his side of the family was, my family didn't want anything to do with them. And I had to go, and my aunt had moved to Atlanta for several years before she had to go off with her daughter. And it had been wonderful for me to have her there. I mean, she was just really a special person to me. And about the time that we took Benjamin, our son, up to college, like a week beforehand, she called and she was in the hospital in Omaha, and she was dying, but she was hooked up to all these machines, and they wouldn't unhook her, and they were just going to keep her alive, and it was just awful. And I had to go out there the day after we took Benjamin to college and talk the doctors into unhooking her. And she was perfectly conscious, and it was a wonderful time that I spent with her. But then I came back, and it was the second day of school, so I had to immediately start teaching. There was nobody I could talk to about this. I couldn't talk to anybody about my aunt. I couldn't talk to anybody about this terrible death. She did not have a funeral. And it was just awful. It was like she had just ceased to be, except within me. And I just carried this around as just a terrible lump until a year and a half later, when I wrote a chapter on her in the book I was working on. But I remember I started it at a place where I was giving a retreat. I started that chapter, and I had my computer. And I sat down at the computer, and people were in the hall and everything, and I wrote the first sentence, and I just started just sobbing hysterically, I mean, really loudly. And it was a year and a half later, and that was my first time to really talk about it, just even talk about it on paper. But there was just no place to do it, and it was just terrible.
And that's why I think it's really important for all of us to find ways of doing it, and find ways of doing it in family and in our communities. In some ways, I think and I don't know, some of you who experienced death or the loss of a loved one, the mourning narratively is diminished now. It just takes on different forms and different expressions. But what I would encourage all of us is to give this some thought and to think about ways of making it possible for our families, for our children, for our communities, to love the memory of those who have died and who have been so much part of our lives and who have contributed so much. And also to help our children know about those who have died so that that memory continues. And in doing so, that we find a family of living. I think when we bury the dead, and we leave them buried, we bury ourselves. You know, we don't continue who we are.
Yes, I might have missed it earlier if you talked about the paper cutouts and what their significance is.
It's a decoration, a celebrative decoration. Would you say, Carmen?
Yeah, it's a traditional art form. I don't know exactly where it comes from because I know in ordinary European countries there's a whole tradition of snowflakes that's very similar to the paper cutout form. But I learned the paper cutout in Mexico. They're very popular there. They have two ways of doing. The way we've done, because I did a workshop a couple of days ago with Ana Maria and other members of the Polish community that came and helped us cut them. We fold them and we cut them. In Mexico, they have actual machines that die cut them. And they're very elaborate. They're usually made in tissue paper. We didn't have tissue paper here in Poland, so we use construction paper. And they're very frail. And they move in the wind. And that's how we decorate our altars and literally our whole house when we meet around the time of Dia de los Muertos. And I think the fragility of the paper symbolizes the fragility of our lives. Like we just, you know, we're just swaying in the wind and one of these days it's just going to rip, fall apart and have to go to the recycle bin. That's what I think of the paper cutouts. The shapes we cut mostly are hearts and angels. And then I remember one year I was cutting out and for some reason my daughter was saying something about pineapple and I said, yeah, pineapple was my mother's favorite food. She said, yeah, my grandma liked pineapple. And I said, yeah, that's why I like pineapple, Mama. And she cut a pineapple to remember her grandma. And those are the little tiny details that we need to know about our ancestors. What they like, what are they like? So they cut different forms like angel crosses and flowers and hearts and different symbols. That comes to mind.
And they're used for other celebratory occasions, for birthdays and for Christmas.
Yeah, for Christmas they use it, but I've seen mostly at Dia de los Muertos.
I saw something that that upset me very much the other day, but for the Cinco de Mayo I was talking about before, Michelob actually made papel picado with Michelob written on papel picado. So in the Mexican restaurant, you have all this papel picado with the Michelob name all over it, see? So those are kind of things we're up against, that onslaught of commercialization that drains the spirit out of, kills the spirit, so to speak.
I just want you to know, it's 11:30, so if you need to go, you can. If you want to stay on a few more moments, welcome to that time.
Okay.
I just wanted to
have you in there. They have pastries, they have candies, they have all these other things that for the other and the shapes of the skulls and crosses and other things. But I just wondered how that works, fits in with the...
In Arizona?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I imagine they have in Arizona. They have in the border. And
oh, yeah. Yeah, we have the bakeries who otherwise just bake regular goods on the Day of the Dead will actually put a lot of time into making the pastel de muerto, pan de muerto, bread of the dead for people to put on their altars. So it really is a whole community that becomes involved. That's really the beautiful thing. Each person brings their own personal feelings, expressions to the event.
But the reason why they eat the candy, you know, I mean, they have sugar skulls and they put the names on the forehead right there. And the kids eat them. And they eat the ones with their names. It's just to remember their own. In Mexico, there's one saying, la única cosa que sabes de la vida es la muerte. The only sure thing you know about life is death. You don't know anything when a child is born, but you know they're going to die. And they live with death very much as part of their lives. I mean, we know that it's right there. You know, you just cannot take a chance and you're gone, you know. And what they do is they humor it and they make fun. And not only they eat the pan de muerto with the name of the person, but I remember a couple of years ago, my son made a mask with his own name and put a skeleton mask on the altar. You know, and it's just like he's trying to tell us that he wants to be remembered and he's remembering himself and making fun of your death. It's like a way to humor yourself through life.
I think that's one of the good things too about the whole idea of continuing it through yourself. It's like if you don't connect yourself with it, you're not preparing the people that you will leave behind either. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the most wonderful things my mother did before she passed away was she had written down so many things that she wanted to share with us after she was gone. She had a list of ways I have been blessed, things that I have loved, you know, people that were important to me. And she made sure that it was there, you know, for us to find afterwards. And I think that that's part of it too, is that while we're remembering other people and our ancestors, that we also have to remember that this is for ourselves and to be making our own plans for our own deaths, to confront ourselves with this in order to help those who we will leave behind. One of the people I worked with years ago hated funerals very much, and she said that she did not want to have a funeral for herself. She wanted to make it clear that they were not to have that when she died. And we often would wonder what a selfish act that was, because you're so uncomfortable with your own death that you're not providing for the needs of the people that are behind you.
We have two more, I think.
I was just curious as to how long is the preparation of the altar, and then when is it taken down, or is it?
Yeah, it is taken down after Dia de los Muertos. We just take it down because there's no sense then we get ready for Guadalupe Day, which is another kind of altar. But we usually start around October 15th. We start saying, oh, where are we going to put the altar this year? What side of the living room? And what are we going to have in the altar? And then we start talking about it, and then we'll start after dinner, clean the table, and do up at the garden.
Yeah, the whole month of October is the preliminary preparations for the day.
But in fact, in many Hispanic homes, not all of them, but in many, there's always some kind of altar. Mm-hmm. Always. And generally, there's pictures of loved ones. I didn't have any here, but you know, you didn't have any with me. Or saints, flowers, candles. There's some form of altar. Or a special sacred corner.
One of the moods that I think I see going on too is not only do people not want to have a memorial service, which I think is a, you mentioned, mm-hmm. but the other mood is that there's a denial of grief where people are, the deceased before they die say, okay, if you're going to have something, do not have a funeral, have a party, and I don't want any crying. It's like binding people up and not permitting them to do that, which is incredibly natural. And I think it's a...
And then congratulate the survivors. Oh, she's taking it so well. She's not physically grieving.
And actually, we should do both, have a party,
sure.
And cry.
Sure, yeah. But we can't see that the two can go together.
Yeah.
I just want to say how grateful I am that you mentioned involving children. I was not involved, and my grandmother died at 9. And so it took me a long time to get comfortable with the whole idea of dying. And I see now that I do hospice work and watch small children be taken through that whole process with a parent. What a different experience that is, and how present they can be to them. And I think the reason, at least I certainly look back on my own family, you know, I wasn't involved because of fear on my parents' part. It didn't have anything to do, I don't think, with what I could or couldn't handle. It was about them, and it's...
And children can take it. When my father died,
very much.
My niece, I said was 4, she came in with a bright red dress, which she had chosen for her, it's like a velvet red dress. And she goes, she says, oh, I go see puppets. I said, fine, we'll go together. So we went together, and she looked at him, and she smiled, and she said, he looks like Sleeping Beauty. But it wasn't a terrible experience, and I think that's what we need to teach our children, mm-hmm. how to see that. You have a comment?
Well, I had another one, but what you just said triggered a situation. We went to the funeral home of a mother who died of cancer very young, and she had two preschool boys. And as we were visiting with the father, the four-year-old boy came up to his dad and said, Daddy, come with me. I need to say goodbye to Mommy one more time. Or again, you know, and he did this continually through the night. About every half hour or so, he had to go and kiss her and say goodbye again. My other question was, I think it's wonderful the way you talk about you know, remembering loved ones and keeping those memories and stories alive. I'm a little curious about how you said after their death you kind of make them into saints and don't remember their imperfections. I think about some friends whose parents were abusive, mm-hmm. or you know, situations where there was a lot of shame, mm-hmm. and I don't think they can just jump to make this person a saintly figure. So I'm wondering if there are some traditions for dealing with not only the grief of loss that they died, but the grief that they might experience because of a difficult life.
Let me just make a correction. It's not that we make them into saints, but somehow I think all of us have had the experience that in life there are certain things that are irksome just because they're irksome, but not because the person necessarily is terrible. You know? So in death, there's certain things that get clarified for us. You know, maybe he was stubborn, but it was for these reasons. So there's a lightness to it, and you can kind of joke about it. But there's some things that are a lot more serious, as you're bringing out. And I'm not quite sure how that quite gets handled in the same way. Probably the truthful way is the way to deal with it. Mm-hmm. You know, to talk about it. This was not what should have happened, but this is what happened. And then in that case, it's not only a process of mourning, of letting go, but of also of forgiving it, of healing, of reconciliation, which all of us do also, I think, in storytelling. Because there's some things that were hurtful, there's some things that we have to forgive, or we're trying to forgive, or we're struggling to forgive. There were some things that happened that maybe happened because our parents didn't have what was required. They didn't have skills. They didn't have a number of things. But, you know, it's not so simple, mm-hmm. as you're pointing out.
But really facilitating a full grief can, I think, allow for what you're saying. Mm-hmm. So there can be some healing from the losses before the physical loss as well.
Could we maybe just take a moment and think about loved ones in our, you know, quietly during the session to a close? So we just thank God for all those people that have been parts of our life, and where we need healing, we ask for healing. Where we need to forgive, we ask to be helped. And we continue to make present all those that are part of who we are today.
It's interesting to think that certain things like this you haven't thought about.